From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Steve Norman reporting the White House assailing Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, saying he undermined President Trump after Mr. Trump left the G7 summit in Quebec early. Trudeau called new U.S. tariffs on Canadian aluminum and steel insulting, and Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister, Chrystia Freeland, responded to previous Trump comments, U.S. security is the impetus for the tariffs.
What is insulting, and what I object to very strongly, is the illegal and unjustified imposition of tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum. The national security pretext is absurd and, frankly, insulting to Canadians, the closest and strongest ally the United States has had.
White House trade advisor Peter Navarro says Canadian leaders have made the worst political miscalculations in modern history. President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un are in Singapore for their summit on denuclearization. Ohio Wesleyan University East Asia scholar Ji-Yong Choi.
It could be a decade-long process rather than, just fast-track approach. Originally, President Trump tried to pursue a fast-track approach, but in my view, he realized that it is practically impossible, so that's why he toned down a little bit.
It's not clear what Kim and President Trump are prepared to offer at the summit tomorrow. Leaders of Ethiopia and Egypt have pledged to iron out their differences over Ethiopia's controversial $4 billion Nile River hydroelectric dam project. Ethiopia's prime minister vowed not to reduce Cairo's share of the vital waterway. This is VOA News. In Baghdad, a storage site for ballot boxes from May's parliamentary election caught fire on Sunday, just days after Parliament ordered a nationwide recount amid allegations of fraud. In a statement, Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi called the act a plot to harm the democracy and the nation. The extent of the damage has not yet been made clear. In an interview Sunday in the British newspaper The Mail, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad insisted that Russia, whose backing since the 2015 has been crucial, is not making decisions for him in prosecuting the country's civil war. He also addressed Iran's influence inside of Syria. James Jeffrey is a former U.S. ambassador and now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
Assad is caught in the middle, and this is really where it is interesting, because Assad doesn't want to become a second Lebanon, totally dependent upon Iran. And therefore, he's playing off Russia and Syria. And Assad has been around a long time now, and of course his father an even longer time before him. And I wouldn't count this guy out.
Assad also told the Mail Western intervention has prolonged the 7-year conflict, but expects it to be over in less than a year, and he restated his aim of taking back the whole country. Meantime, in northwest Idlib province, at least 10 people were killed. It happened in the town of Toftavaz. The National Puerto Rican Parade in New York turned into a usual boisterous celebration on Sunday, but many participants also saw it as an occasion to express their somber concerns over the devastation caused by Hurricane Maria last year. Patricia Diaz came in from Puerto Rico to take part in the parade, says it was all bittersweet.
It's a very emotional time. It was a lot of hardship right after the hurricane. So it's awesome to be able to celebrate our heritage, celebrate that we're survivors, celebrate that we made it. We actually made it.
Along the parade route in New York City, people carried signs with tributes like New York stands with Puerto Rico. Even today, Puerto Rico remains ravaged by the hurricanes. Electrical power utilities remain out in many areas. Spain's Rafael Nadal has won the 11th French Open this Sunday. It happened, defeating Austria's Dominic Thiem 6-4, 6-3, 6-2.
It's very emotional for me. It was a very special moment, and 2 minutes of the crowd supporting, or that feeling in that moment, was difficult to describe, but very emotional for me.
32-year-old world number one player now has 17 Grand Slam titles. Get more news at voanews.com. I'm Steve Norman in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Morning Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Monday, June the 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you. The Italian government says that it will refuse to let a humanitarian ship carrying more than 600 migrants dock at its port. It has also asked the Mediterranean island of Malta to open its doors to the vessel. And Ugandan legislators are calling on their government to conduct investigations into the recent wave of violence in the country following the murder of a member of parliament from the ruling party.
And the killers have no shame. That's why they have gone for the children, they have gone for the women, they have gone for religious leaders. They are now only the members of parliament.
Opposition member of parliament Winfred Kiza. And we bring you some sad news from our home front. Leo Sarkisian, the creator and longtime producer of Voice of America's longest-running English program, Music Time in Africa, has died. He was 97 years old. Leo spent decades collecting music and sounds from the African continent.
I mean, this is African history through music that I'm sure has been lost otherwise. He did capture it.
Heather Maxwell is the current host of Music Time in Africa. She took over from the late Leo Sarkisian in 2012. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. We start with some sad news. Leo Sarkisian, the creator and longtime producer of the Voice of America's longest-running English program, Music Time in Africa, has died. Leo, who was commonly known as the Music Man of Africa, spent many years traveling across Africa, listening to local musicians and capturing their sounds. He played their music on his program, Music Time in Africa. Leo retired from the show in 2012 at the age of 91. The current host of Music Time in Africa, Heather Maxwell, tells me that Leo will be remembered for capturing African history through music.
Leo Sarkisian was known across Africa from 1965 up until 2012 as the voice of Music Time in Africa. He was the founder of that radio show that is now my show. And he was also known as being the Music Man of Africa.
Aside from hosting the show here in Washington, D.C., what else did he do for African music?
Well, in the beginning, in the late 50s and 60s, he was based in Liberia, and he was setting up the new countries at that time, their radio stations. He was training people with on the technology of it, engineers, and then at the same time he was recording and African music from all of the places that he visited. He was a big fan of a traditional music, so he would go out with big teams with their heavy equipment and their old style microphones and their reel to reel tape, and he would record musicians in villages, as well as recording music in brand new studios in some of these new radio stations.
Mm. How long did he host the show?
He hosted the show all the way up until 2004. Now, he had a series of female hosts, that presenters that would introduce the show, and then he would come on as the expert in the middle of the show with this brand new recording from, you know, Ethiopia or this brand new one from Nigeria, and he would talk about it. He was an ethnomusicologist. He was the expert.
All right, so you have one of the recordings for Music Time in Africa at the time when Leo Sarkisian was hosting it. Let's listen to it.
Okay, this is a recording of Fela, at the time Fela Ransom Kuti, in a studio in Nigeria, in Lagos, before he found his Afrobeat sound. So he was doing more of a jazz, American jazz style.
So Leo Sarkisian is probably one of the very few Western journalists or ethnomusicologist that interacted with Fela Kuti before he found his
Afrobeat sound.
When did you take over the show? When did you start hosting the show? And how has the show changed with you as the host of the show? Are you continuing in the footsteps of Leo Sarkisian?
Well, I started the show in 2012. I had come from Mali and came straight directly to D.C. to start the show. And, you know, in some ways, it's very much like Leo's. I respect and admire Leo and his work tremendously, so I would never want to stray too far from what he does. But given that it's a different time today, and in Leo's most important thing was reaching audiences and communicating with people. They weren't just audiences, they were individuals with names and families, and that was so important to him. And it is to me too, but we can't do it the same way Leo did.
Right.
So now my show is longer. It's a 55-minute format, and Leo's was 30-minute. I have a huge social media component because that's how people communicate today.
Mm-hmm.
And a YouTube channel. I try to present as much visual
elements
of music as I can. But I keep it the same in another way, which is traditional music is still extremely important for me. And I always have some traditional music in my programs.
So Leo spent so many of, like you said, spent many years in Africa, traveling in these different communities, recording their music. What happened to that library, to that catalog of music? Is it something that you tap into as you host the show these days?
I do.
Where is the music?
Yeah, that's a great question. Number one, the library itself was here at VOA, and then several years ago, we moved it to a university, the University of Michigan, precisely, to have it digitized and up and available on the internet for access to everyone around the world, and a searchable database so that you can say, I want to hear music from 1965, Cameroon.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do those searches, and that his radio shows and his music from that part of the world at that time is going to pop up.
It has a wooden sound box with a skin stretched over it.
I mean, this is African history through music that I'm sure has been lost otherwise. He did capture it.
Heather Maxwell is the host of Music Time in Africa here on The Voice of America. She was talking to me about the legacy of the late Leo Sarkisian. Leo passed away recently at the age of 97. In Uganda, members of parliament are calling on the government to investigate the recent wave of violence in the country following the murder of a member of parliament from the ruling National Resistance Movement Party. The member of parliament, Ibrahim Abiriga, gained national attention in Uganda for his support of the controversial constitutional amendment last year, which removed the presidential age limit. From Kampala, Uganda, reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji has this report.
A rural member of parliament, Colonel Ibrahim Abiriga, was gunned down alongside his bodyguard last Friday as went to his home in Kawanda in Kampala suburb. Uganda's Prime Minister Ruhakana Rugunda described Abiriga as a man who loved not only the ruling party, the National Resistance Movement, but the whole nation at large. Rugunda called the killers cowards and said the government will hand them down and bring them to the courts of law.
The killers of Honorable Abiriga will be hunted down and brought to justice. We should all be vigilant to ensure that killings of this nature are fought and defeated once and for all. The agents of these evil acts want to instill fear among the Wananchi, but would like to assure all Ugandans that they will not succeed.
According to eyewitnesses, the assailants were traveling on a motorcycle locally known as Boda Boda. Abiriga was one of the staunchest proponents of the move to amend the constitution to remove age limits. He said the removal of age limits would grant President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni a chance to lead Uganda perpetually. At the occasion, to another slain member of parliament, opposition member of parliament Winifred Chiza said the government must improve the security in the country.
The killers of Honorable Abiriga will be hunted down and brought to justice. We should all be vigilant to ensure that killings of this nature are fought and defeated once and for all. The agents of these evil acts want to instill fear among the Wanichi, but would like to assure all Ugandans that they will not succeed.
Several prominent members of the government, security, business, as well as religious leaders have been shot dead in the recent days. Chiza says this must stop.
Let us rise up to the occasion and start speaking about the insecurity in this country. Killings will have no color. Killings will have no status. Killings have no shame. And the killers have no shame. That's why they have gone for the children, they have gone for the women, they have gone for religious leaders, they are now on you, the members of parliament.
Andrew Badiayanga, an independent member of parliament, agrees.
We need to be reassured that security organs of our nation are still in charge, that it is safe for one to move to their homes and not be attacked by machete wielding thugs at their gates, that women will not be waylaid, raped and killed, that Ugandans are safe from kidnaps. The security of every Ugandan is a must. It is a must and has to be guaranteed.
Abiriga served as a soldier and a civil servant before joining politics. He'll be laid to rest later today in the northern Uganda district of Arua. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
In a few months, the government of Malawi will hold a national population and housing census. But before the actual exercise starts in September this year, the government is embarking on a campaign to sensitize communities on the census and some of the myth around the exercise. Lamek Masina has more from Blantyre.
Authorities say the campaign seeks to dispel growing myths on the existence of blood-sucking vampires, which they fear may affect the implementation of the exercise. Strangers were recently attacked by communities in rural parts of Malawi on suspicion that they were bloodsuckers. For example, in February, angry mob in a rural area of Kalonga district, north of Malawi, assaulted a film crew from British Broadcasting Corporation, or BBC, on suspicion that they were blood-sucking vampires. They were with a local journalist filming a documentary on witchcraft and other traditional beliefs. Government ambulances and NGO workers were also assaulted in rural areas of southern Malawi, forcing UN agencies withdraw their workers there. Isaac Chir was the assistant commissioner at the National Statistics Office.
We are using the trusted voices in the localities where these myths exist. So we are partnering with the chiefs, or we ask them to be our advocates. They will be given the messages and disseminate them to the public in their areas.
Chirwa also says the campaign will also engage community radio stations to help inform people that there is nothing sinister about the census. Malawi last conducted its population and housing census in 2008, which showed the country had a population of 13 million people. However, recent estimates show that the number of people is about to reach 18 million. Kudo Gondo is the Minister of Finance, Economic Planning and Development. He says the rapid population growth is bad to the country's economy. The International Monetary Fund has ranked Malawi third poorest country in the world, a drop from position 6 last year.
Our income per capita now is just above $400 per person. Supposing the population was half this, then it means that our income per capita would be 800. And at 800, it means that we would have less poverty in the country.
UN agencies are supporting the exercise. Clara Anyangwe is the representative of UN Women in Malawi.
As the United Nations were providing the technical support to the government of Malawi in terms of the training of enumerators, and after that we're also going to be supporting the actual collection of the data. And you know, after the collection of the data, we have to analyze the data and also ensure that all the census reports are produced.
Authorities say the results of the census will also be used in the development of next vision after the expiry of Vision 2020 in 2 years' time. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
The East African community is studying new ways to fund its own budget. Almost half of its budget is donor-funded, and this has raised concerns over the implementation of the regional integration agenda, as some partner states are under sanctions. Moses Havyarimana reports from Nairobi.
As the East African Community Legislative Assembly passed the community's budget of the year 2018-2019, that saw a decrease of $10 million compared to last year's budget. Member states have called on the community not to be donor dependent. Jean-Marie Muhirwa is a lawmaker from Burundi.
If we really want to enjoy and our citizens enjoy this integration, we have to have our own mechanisms of financing this integration. If we are not prudent enough, there is a risk that we be colonized again.
Development partners support other member countries, excluding Burundi officials. This comes after European Union suspended direct aid to the Burundi government since 2015, citing human rights violations in the country. Burundi since then faced financial difficulties that also delayed its contribution to the community budget, as member states are required to contribute at least $8.3 million per financial year. Julius Maganda is the state minister of East African Community Affairs from Uganda. He explains the new self-funding mechanism.
The problem comes that most of the partner states did not agree how the levy will apply based on their sizes of the economy and the development within those economies. So that's where the deal-dallying has been. So we are looking at many variables which will come into play. That's why we have put up this committee to do a research.
According to the East African Community Council of Ministers, member states can be able to fund the community's budget if a levy of 1% or less is imposed on imported goods. A new East African Community audit report indicated an overall budget performance of 65%. However, lack of budgetary planning and gross irregularities were observed in the report. Liberanfo Mukeko is the East African Community Secretary General.
This report is a clean audit report, so which means that 90% of the things that the community is doing them right. However, there are some areas of concern, and the procurement is an area of concern because they were able to pick a few irregularities, mainly non-compliance with some of the provisions of the financial rules and regulations.
East African Community maintained its position as the fastest growing sub-region in Africa, with an estimated growth of 4.6% in 2017, up from 4.4% in 2016. Financing its own budget remains the key priority for the community in order to implement the region's integration programs. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, and today is Monday, June the 11th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. And it's time for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you, Jackson. We begin with Ghana Football Association, where members of the GFA will not be able to join the FIFA Congress on Wednesday in Russia that is set for voting on the host of the 2026 FIFA World Cup due to a travel ban imposed by the Ghana government. The decision came in the light of corruption charges that forced the GFA president, Kwesi Nyatachi, to resign from his position following a ban from all football activities by FIFA for 90 days. The Ghanaian government decided to dissolve its National Football Association following the video surfacing
of Ghanaian officials accepting bribes before marches. Subsequently, officials who were supposed to represent the GFA at the 68th FIFA Congress instead of Nyatachi to cast their votes to elect the host nation for the 2026 World Cup were banned from traveling by the government. Staying with the FIFA's World Cup bid, FIFA's ruling council has put forward both the joint North American and Moroccan bids for the 2026 World Cup to a vote at the Congress on Wednesday. The United 2026 and Moroccan 2026 bids will now go head-to-head at the FIFA Congress following the ratification from the council. And now to the 2018 FIFA World Cup, which begins in less than 3 days' time. Nigeria's Super Eagles jersey to the tournament has been adjudged to be the most sought after by fans all over the globe. According to a poll carried out by Spanish respected newspaper Marca, English and Spanish site rated the Super Eagles kit as number one. France joined Nigeria in the second position, while Nigeria group opponent Croatia came third in the pool. To other World Cup stories now, Liverpool forward Mohamed Salah sat out training again on Sunday following the Egyptian team's arrival in Grozny ahead of the World Cup in Russia, nursing a shoulder injury suffered during his first half tangle with Sergio Ramos in the Champions League final. Mohamed Salah did come out onto the pitch in Grozny to greet fans eager to catch a glimpse of the record-breaking Liverpool star. The Pharaohs are set to play their first World Cup game on Friday against Uruguay in Ekaterinburg. Elsewhere, the Atlas Lions and the Pharaohs are the latest African teams to arrive for the World Cup after Tunisia, Morocco and Egypt have landed in Russia for the 2028 FIFA World Cup that starts on June the 14th. Morocco arrived in their World Cup base in the early hours of Sunday after their 3-1 defeat of Estonia on Saturday. One of Africa's flag bearers at the 2018 World Cup, Soccer Fiesta, Tunisia, lost narrowly to a not-too-impressive Spanish side 1-0 as the Spaniards wrapped up their preparations for the 2018 World Cup. Spain's next game will be on June the 15th at a World Cup against Cristiano Ronaldo and Portugal, while its other two Group B opponents will be Iran and Morocco. Tunisia will play its first match in Russia against England in Group G on June 18th and then square off in its final two-round robin games against Belgium and Panama. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. And that's it for this Monday, June the 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew team, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day, Africa.
It's the weekend, and whatever you're doing, you could use a little extra love. Music love, that is. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa, and I've got the perfect weekend show for you.
I'm the king of the kuntu, and the loving the way I do this uncle.
First, a 30-minute playlist of the continent's best music. Then, a live studio interview and music performance by Leni Stern Trio. Think award-winning female electric guitar player falls in love with West African griot music. Of love coming to you this weekend. Don't miss it on Music Time in Africa, Sunday and the following Saturday at 15 and 2000 UTC. Yeah!
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndumbulu and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.